Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with veteran Brooklyn-based jazz saxophonist, clarinetist, and composer Jeff Lederer. We talked to him in early January 2022 about his latest 2021 CD, Eightfold Path. It is spiritual jazz and a revival of the Sun Watcher Quartet he formed back in 2011 to celebrate the music of Albert Eiler. Little Eye Music is a Brooklyn-based record label founded by Jeff, and it produces creative music in the jazz and improvised music fields. He's been included in the Downbeat's Critics and Readers Poll every year since 2014. He's got great stories. Enjoy.
So, Jeff, thanks for taking a minute out for Neon Jazz, man. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to speak with you.
So I think the subtext of what we're going to talk about up front here is the elephant in the room in the world, which is COVID. And, you know, your Eightfold Path album that came out last year, what was it like to get new material out? And, you know, once upon a time, as this virus undulates, there was a chance to perform live. What was it like to kind of have that as an option?
Yeah, well, with this particular one, the Eightfold Path music, it really was not intended to be music that I was sharing with the world in a way. So we're putting ourselves back in the calendar to midsummer 20. Boy, it's hard to keep track of the years at this point, isn't it? Midsummer 2020. So around June, and of course we were just kind of in the first few months of the pandemic, and I'm very, very blessed and fortunate to have this. I live in New York in Brooklyn, but I have a little cabin. Myself and my wife have a small place in the woods of Vermont. So at that point we were way up there in the woods, and when I say in the woods, I mean really miles and miles away from any other folks, which was an incredible fortunate blessing to have in our lives at that time. So we were up there quite a bit during that summer, the entire summer. And of course, you know, doing things that everybody was doing. And I'm sure you've spoken to a lot of folks who've talked about their artistic approaches and reactions to what happened during that time. So we were doing our thing. I wasn't playing with other folks, obviously. And my good dear friend, Jamie Saft, the fantastic keyboardist, organist, pianist, he finally started to invite me over to his place in Woodstock, New York, and said that he was doing some recording with folks outside on his front lawn. So that sounded intriguing. I was like, great, man, let's do that. We found a date on the calendar, which wasn't sort of tough at that time. And I said, hey, let's invite Matt Wilson to come up from the city, and found a date that the great drummer Matt Wilson could come up. And at that point, we were just going to maybe play Free, which is what we do a lot, or possibly play a little of the repertoire of Albert Eiler or Alice Coltrane, which me and Jamie have explored quite a bit. Jamie then said, you know, Steve Swallow, an amazing, iconic musician who lives in that area, he and Jamie have long-standing relationship. He said, well, maybe Steve would like to come over and play. I said, well, that sounds good to me. I didn't know Swallow at that point. As it turns out, Steve was available to come over. In a sense, what I'm saying is it kind of felt like we were just getting together to play, and we did, and we played on Jamie's front lawn. And, you know, just 2 days before the session, rather than playing Free or playing the repertoire that we've kind of done before, I started to make sketches based on some things that I had been reading and thinking. And that's kind of how it evolved. So long answer to a short question, it was not planned out as a recording project for release. It was just kind of, let's get together and experience the joy of playing together.
And some of your compositions are based on writings of a Buddhist monk, and you call it spiritual jazz. Talk to me a little bit about that element that goes into this recording.
When I say I wrote some tunes based on things I'd been thinking and reading, that was really primarily based on reading of a Vietnamese Buddhist monk whose name is Thich Nhat Hanh. And he's somebody that's familiar to a lot of folks because in addition to being a really deep thinker, he's also an amazing writer and a great communicator. And he's Vietnamese, but came over during the 1960s to protest the United States military action in Vietnam. And he stayed, and he's been in the United States a lot. There are a lot of communities of folks who kind of follow his thinking. And he's now back in Vietnam, I believe, in his older part of his life. The reading that I was doing was out of his books, and in particular, one book, which The Heart of the Buddha's Teaching, which outlined this concept called the Eightfold Path. So just to give you a little background information, long time ago when I attended Oberlin College in Ohio, I was not a music student. I was a comparative religion major, and I've done a lot of things throughout my life, including my group called Shakers and Bakers, which explores spiritual traditions of the Shaker sect. I've always been an explorer and interested and a reader, and so this particular structure of the Eightfold Path, and we can talk more about that later, lends itself to some musical sketches. So that's how that evolved.
Speaking of spirituality and reflection, you know, this time of COVID has given all of us a time to really kind of look within. What have you learned about yourself over this time of lockdown quarantine that maybe you didn't realize before that's going to make you stronger as we all kind of reemerge this year?
I'm an optimist. I believe we are reemerging. I even put a couple of dates on my calendar for the summer, so that's exciting. So when you say, what have we learned, that's a tough one, because going into the pandemic, there was this funny bell curve emotionally, and the, you know, the bell curve has been up and down ever since, for sure, for all of us. But in a sense, of course, there was this instant kind of shock and horror at what our world was turning into. But at the same time, some artists and musicians felt this burst of energy like, wow, I can really explore or get deep into this or that thing, writing-wise, improvisation-wise, that I've been thinking about. Now I have the time to do it. And I think some folks really felt a great pressure to learn or to understand things better. So what I'm saying is, I liked the structure of the Eightfold Path in Thich Nhat Hanh's writings and in the Buddha's teachings, because it's not so much about what you learn, but it is a way to live on a daily basis. So there isn't something, I always tell folks, you know, I'm not a member of a Buddhist community, but I've learned to structure my life in ways that I think are positive for myself and for the community around me, and hopefully, you know, for the whole world in the big picture of things. And that's the wisdom of what I was reading in the Eightfold Path. Just little ways that you can conduct yourself in life that are positive. So then you go back to, what have you learned? I don't think I've learned anything deep about the universe over the last 2 years, but I have learned on a very small scale, daily basis, what are things that you can do in your life that are positive and for yourself and others. And those things, I had a great chance to write one of those Woodshed articles in the Downbeat magazine for last October. And so I relate those things very specifically to musical practicing. And so I have gained quite a bit out of that, for sure.
Talk to me a little bit about how this jazz journey began for you. You know, there's always a flashpoint that pulls you in and you expand from there. What musician moment, you know, kind of where did you grow up? How did it all begin for you?
Yeah, so I grew up in Los Angeles, California. Well, of course, it has a great jazz history and legacy, but not really known as a hotbed of jazz in the 1970s as much. Of course, there was an amazing scene on Central Avenue in Los Angeles in the 1950s, and the Beboppers and Ornette and Mingus. And anyway, but for me, growing up kind of in a beach community in the west side of L.A., it was not in the air so much, but there were a few very pivotal things that happened. One is, I connected actually through a sister who was friends with a genius saxophonist in Los Angeles, whose name is Marty Crystal. Not a name everybody knows, but a name people should know, because he's still out there doing it in L.A. Wonderful, wonderful woodwind player, improvising saxophonist, and he was a teacher to me. His main thing was that he played duo at the time, late 70s, early 80s, with Buell Neidlinger, the amazing bassist, whose claim to fame, which he would say as his gigs, was that he was the only bassist who played with Igor Stravinsky, Cecil Taylor, and Frank Zappa. So that was Buell, who was amazing. And these guys had this incredible scene going. So I kind of grew up in the freer side, the freer perspectives on the music, or this beautiful open perspective on the music that Marty provided me, even while during our lessons, we were studying the melodies of Charlie Parker, the melodies of Thelonious Monk. And in fact, in the early lessons, he would never let me improvise until I really knew the melodies, which was pretty fantastic in hindsight. So that's where I kind of started off. And then there were a few key compatriots in high school who we made this journey. One in particular is a clarinetist who unfortunately passed early, young. His name was Jeff Walker. I like to mention his name as often as possible. Just a brilliant young clarinetist in Los Angeles. And he and I climbed into his old Chevy Nova or whatever it was. And this is, again, late 70s, early 80s. And we, every night, we just drive hours to find anywhere where there was a jam session in Los Angeles where we could play a tune. And the folks and the people that we interacted with, in fact, were some folks who were the remnants of the Central Avenue bebop scene of Los Angeles from the earlier decades. And so I did get to experience and learn this music from the source on the bandstand rather than in a school setting so much, which was really great.
So what was the first live jazz show that you ever saw that really kind of blew your doors down?
Good. I hadn't thought about this, but I actually can pull it up. My mother took me to see, at age 14, a saxophonist named Joe Roccasano. Roccasano was a great alto player, he's an East Coast guy, but he lived in the West Coast for many years and was a successful writer, arranger, and a great player. So she took me to see Roccasano play when I was 14, and I really dug that. And very shortly after that, the same summer, she took me down to the Lighthouse in Hermosa Beach, where we saw Phil Woods' quartet at that time, with Bill Goodwin, Hal Galper, and Steve Lesmina, I guess, on bass. Anyway, both those shows just blew me away. They were really amazing and strong memories. And of course, I had to remind Roccasano of that when, many years later in New York, I was playing occasionally. He had a fine big band here in New York, and I would come in once in a while and play, and I love to remind him of that.
You know, over the years, you've had the chance to play with a lot of cats and see a lot of things. What did you learn over all those years that you've used as an educator now with students that you're around?
You're right. I've been blessed to play with amazing musicians. Some compatriots, colleagues that I've played with side by side for years and years, and I still have these important relationships with. And among those, I'll say first, my wife, the amazing vocalist Mary LaRose, my dear friend Matt Wilson, the incredible jazz drummer, and the great salsa trombonist Jimmy Bosch, all these folks who I've had musical relationships with going on 30 years now, and I've learned tremendous things from all of them. But then there's also like the legends, Buster Williams. I can't believe I recorded with Buster, and of course Steve Swallow and the new record, and all these folks that I get to mix it up with occasionally, which is so fantastic. And I guess if you were going to put it into a short statement that I do echo to the students, is that when we're starting playing this music, there's two key elements, which is the begin and the end, in a way, the alpha and the omega of this music. And that is, for me, sound and time, those two things. I had a little time off before my semester begins out here, and so, guilty pleasures. I never do this anymore, but I'm sitting around playing with my favorite records, as we all do. So yesterday was The Kicker, Joe Henderson, and Bob Byrd with Cedar Walton, Eastern Rebellion 2, and all these tenor players who kind of shaped my thinking. Anyway, but, with those guys, Joe and Bob Byrd, like these incredible harmonic things, they're doing all this stuff. In the end, it comes down to the two things, sound and time. Sound, what is the sound that you're putting out there on the saxophone or whatever instrument you're playing, and time, how are you placing those sounds in time? We could say time means in rhythm, but it doesn't always mean in rhythm like pulse rhythm. It can be very, very flexible ways of looking at time, but sound and time. And, unfortunately, jazz education is a wonderful thing, and right now I'm missing the Gen Conference in Dallas, so that's fine. But we tend to start with students these days with what the younger musicians are now calling language or vocabulary. That's cool. Folks say that. But what they mean is licks and patterns, and that's all good stuff. I work with students on that stuff. But if you don't have these two fundamentals together first, sound and time, then you're not going anywhere with the rest of the stuff.
You've been at this for a long time, and this is kind of a twofold question. My first part of this is, what do you like the best about being a professional musician, and what has been the key to your longevity?
Yeah, thank you. I got a milestone birthday this year, too, so I'm feeling it. Anyway, the first part of the question was...
The first part was,
What do I like about it? Yeah, what do I like about
it? What's the best part of being a professional musician, yeah.
Yeah. So, in short, it's connecting with other people, and that's the broadest way to say it. And I mean connecting with other musicians, and I mean connecting with just people. And that's, again, with the going back to the pandemic thing, that's something we're all missing, like the physical pleasure of playing music. We miss the money, let's be straight up. We miss a lot about it. But what we miss most is connecting with people, and that's not just musicians. Of course, that's the whole world. That's been, you know, in addition to, like, pain, suffering, loss of life, it's the lack of connection with other human beings that's been hurting all of us the most. So the great part of being a professional musician is that connection aspect, and there's many ways to be a professional musician. I was very blessed that I have both this kind of teaching career, but I also still have been, you know, have an active touring, performing career, and the travel part of it, you know, it's just so, so wonderful. And of course, we all miss the touring, traveling part. I did get recently, November, December, there was 3 weeks of travel and tours. 1 week with a great new group that I'm recording with this week, bassist Joe Fonda's quartet. Very interesting group where I'm playing all woodwinds, no saxophone. Bassoonist Michael Rabinowitz, Fonda on bass, and Harvey Sorgan on drums. Pretty interesting music. Anyway, I did a week out with them, a week with Joe Feidler, the great trombonist. His group opened Sesame, which is super great and fun, playing the music of Sesame Street, which Joe knows well because he's the musical director of the show, but with a real creative perspective. And then a week with the Christmas Trio with Matt Wilson and Paul Sakivi. So I was actually got to be out there again, and you're seeing folks. And when I say seeing folks, I mean seeing the presenters, not fans, I mean the presenters, all the people who go into making this whole world of music and jazz. And it sounds a bit cliche, but it's a family. You know, we go from town to town and I see that club or that presenter, that guy who, or girl, or woman who runs a nonprofit. And it's just to be seeing them again is such a wonderful thing. It's a family aspect. So that's kind of, that connection is really my favorite part of being a professional musician.
So everyone has a perception of you, your family, your friends, your fans, your students, but ultimately you live your life, you perceive who you are. Who do you think you are?
That's not a hard question at all, is it?
No.
At this point, well, of course, there's who I am as a person, and that starts at home and with my family and two beautiful children and a beautiful wife. And I don't know how I got so blessed in this lifetime to have all that and still be playing my horn. But just in general, I'm out in behind my house in Brooklyn. I have a little garage studio thing. It's really nice. And there's a photograph on the wall of my first professional gig. And it is, I was talking about age 14, going to see these folks play with my mom. And it is age 14. And my mom bought me the suit I'm wearing in this picture. It's a pinstripe suit from JCPenney. I'm playing the alto saxophone. I'm standing next to the clarinetist I told you about earlier who passed away early, Jeff Walker. And the man to the left side of me is Lawrence Welk holding an accordion, which is kind of incredible. But that was my first professional gig. And Lawrence Welk came out to Boys and Girls Club of Venice Beach dinner dance as the guest of honor. And he played with our band, which was kind of a kid trad jazz band in LA. Just a funny scene. And he brought the bubble machine, so there's bubbles in the photograph. But what I'm getting around to is, like, it's great right now to be looking at that picture and look at the expression in my face, because I'm playing Honeysuckle Rose with Lawrence Welk. And I remember it well. It was really swinging. And there's an excitement about it. Just I know I was able to connect with the excitement of that moment, just the way I still am. It's the same feeling I get now whenever I'm playing music, and that's with Steve Swallow or with my students. It's this excitement of that moment of playing music, and that's really maybe the best version of me, or that's what we all do, all of this crazy work and effort to get to that point where we can put it all aside and be in the moment, experiencing the joy of that moment. And again, looking at this photograph, I can see in my face just that moment is encapsulated there. And to bring that back to Eightfold Path, there's quite a bit of the thinking in Thich Nhat Hanh, which, and in the Buddha's, you know, teachings, that is about bringing your own mind back to experiencing that moment and really be present in the moment, which is what we all want to do as improvisers and as human beings. And for sure, when I'm able to do that, that's the best version of myself. So there you go. Long answer.
I like it. Jeff, thanks, man, for opening up with about the new album, about your life and music, COVID. Good luck with everything as we move forward.
Thank you, and to you as well. And thank you for doing the work you do. It's really great to put these conversations out there.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in Brooklyn, Kansas City, and spots all over the world, giving fans all that jazz. Thanks to Jeff for his time, music, and story. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Domino in the iTunes Store. Visit NeonJazz at YouTube.com, and for everything Neon Jazz all the time, go to theneonjazz.blogspot.com. Until next time, enjoy the jazz, my friends.
Neon Jazz.